In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On this show, we've covered topics such as the eventual transition to renewable or free energy systems, telluric energy, and the deliberate exploitation of this natural realm with guests such as Peter Shampoo, Matthew Deleuze, Dr. Ross Hamilton, and Dr. Carmen Bolter. There are threads from these past shows that connect together, such as how ley lines tend to carry telluric current, electromagnetic energy that affect our glial cells. Telluric current fuels creativity, as discussed in a past show that mapped hidden New York City ley lines. We also discussed an ancient, powerful ley line nexus in Washington, D.C., below the Capitol building. But before that was built, it was a sacred meeting location for indigenous tribes. With this background and context, we connect in with the career path of geophysicist Dr. Brandon Brigadier, who conducted surveys across the continent for oil, coal, and geothermal energy. He at one point became part of a geothermal exploration team named Group 7. We'll also examine his involvement and knowledge of related secret projects such as Project Moondust. His experiences strengthen parallels to the sacred Native American sites and cultures and support his analysis that the land shall conquer all. Dr. Brandon Brigadier graduated from the Colorado School of Mines in 1978 and in 1980 graduated with bachelor's and master's degrees in geophysical engineering. He's also a graduate of St. John's Law School with a JD in Energy and Environmental Law. Dr. Brigadier, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me on. Please call me Brandon. We've been such good friends over the years. It's a real pleasure to be with you tonight.
Well, Brandon, you're a listener to In Other News and a supporter, and you were also a frequent caller when we took calls years ago. You're a WBAI member and support the station, and for all of that, thanks very much. You've had an interesting career trajectory that connects in with some of the past topics on In Other News. A natural feature and abundant resource in this country are geothermal and hydrothermal convection systems, underground reservoirs, and geysers. Let's start with, if you would please, by describing for listeners how a geothermal plant operates and then how you got involved in working with geothermal energy.
Great. Just let me preface it with a short little tutorial about a minute on what geophysics is about. It is what I practice right now, and geophysics may be best understood in terms of remote sensing of certain quality factors of the Earth and its media. There are things like acoustic velocities or vibrationals through the media, electromagnetic quality factors like conductivity or resistivity, dielectric densities, different densities. There's magnetic qualities, things like heat flow, radioactive and other properties in thermal. And Jeff, I know over the years you've heard the name of different instrumentations that we use, like seismometers, magnetometers, gravity meters, electromagnetic receivers, radiation scintillators, and spectrometers. So that's the sort of equipment that we use.
HARP?
And, yeah, HARP is an interesting derivative of the Tesla technologies, too. So a lot of what we do here certainly has to do with Tesla, people even going back to Franklin and the like. And we all stand on the shoulders of giants. But to answer your question as to the source of first heat and then water to make the hydrothermal systems, the Earth, you know, as it was formed billions of years ago, was impacted by meteors. There were then a hard crust that formed and the movement of plates. So there was a mechanical stimulation like rubbing your hands together. But as you recall, there are radioactive isotopes within the Earth that constantly heat up as they break down. There's things like tidal friction due to the moon and Earth stimulating the Earth. It's almost like If you've ever played handball, Jeff, you know how the ball gets warm as you hit it around and squeeze it. Things like the rotating magnetic angular momentum of the Sun and Jupiter engage the Earth also as a magnetizing body. And other things, too, like the Earth is constantly being cooked by the Sun, by microwave and other frequencies. So that's the heat sources. Water then percolates onto the surface of the Earth and then enters into the interior and in the pore spaces with coming close to the sources of heat, sometimes as magma chambers or what are known as batholiths underneath mountains. We sometimes get surface manifestations of the water as it comes into contact with heat, producing surficial manifestations like geysers and hot springs. But in a lot of instances, Jeff, the water that we want or the hot steam that we're trying to develop to the surface is not readily available. So we use the geophysical techniques to then produce good drilling sites. So then in terms of operation of a geothermal plant, the geophysicist goes out, if it's not readily obvious where to drill, and using these different techniques, tries to identify places where high heat flow, possibly underground magma chambers, are producing boiling water or even steam. So that's what we're trying to do, is drill into those pockets of steam and hot water, bring it to the surface, and in many standard fossil fuel plants, coal or oil or gas are burnt and combusted to produce then boiling water and steam. Now, the steam from a geothermal plant is coming right out of the earth in closed piping. We put it then through a cased-covered steam turbine, and that's basically like a long, long shaft with propellers on them or turbine blades. And as the steam from the interior of the earth passes over the blades of the steam turbine, it rotates the shaft. That shaft is connected to an electric generator, and the changing magnetic field of the stator and the rotor, the armature, the wires of the generator, produce then the electricity, the voltage, and depending on the speed of rotation and the admitted steam, voltages and hertz are produced to, you know, again, produce electricity, as is normally done in other fossil fuel plants. The waste fluids, called the working fluid, is then returned to the earth, and very little emissions occur.
I have this map of geothermal sites, hydrothermal sites, in the western part of the United States. And this is a map, I think, within the Assessment of Geothermal Resources of the United States, 1978. And there are many of them. It seems like close to 100. How many geothermal energy plants are there in the United States?
Well, the biggest one is the geysers field where I worked for Union Geothermal. It was originally developed by Magma Power back in 1960. But in terms of the dry steam or very hot water, which is able to flash the steam, smaller electricity-generating geothermal plants, I'd say right now about 20, 30 or so. So right now, I think the total output in terms of electricity is about 4,000, maybe more, megawatts of power. So it's about 4 gigawatts. Most of it, like you say, Jeff, is in the West, but with good or better transmission lines, we really could bring a lot of that, just like the available wind in the Midwest or the solar energy down in the Southwest. The unavailability, say, of transmission is what's keeping geothermal energy electricity from the East Coast market. And, of course, there are line losses the farther along you have to push the electricity from the point of generation.
You referenced Tesla's technology earlier, and is that what is involved transferring the energy into electricity through the geothermal steam?
Absolutely. You know, it's a really good example, Jeff. I know you're very well invested in the Tesla technology, the free energy, what I call alternative renewables. We're talking about working fluids. When you talk about geothermal steam or hot water that will be flashed to steam to push the turbine blades, Tesla's real a breakthrough, I think, and provenation or proof of his technology was when he developed, basically on his own, the alternating polyphase electric generation in the hydroelectric plants up there in Niagara Falls. So let's give him that credit and know then that it wasn't really Edison's work with the direct current, but the alternating current that was found to be much better on long transmission lines. And I would really have to say that were it not for Franklin's work on electricity and the atmosphere and Tesla's grounding of electricity and then his knowledge of how to get free electricity from the Earth, we would all today be still rubbing sticks together to try to light the night.
Since we're on this topic of alternating current and direct current, I've heard that direct current was problematic because of running electricity across miles of power lines would tend to heat up if it were direct current. Is that true?
That's my understanding, too. You're getting me a little bit beyond my ken. In addition to being a geophysicist, my background includes working on power company claims throughout the United States. The only direct current power plant I ever saw was a small hydroelectric plant out in California. And it was really funny the way they had arcing in the DC plant, how short the distance was to the production of the DC current out to lighting in the area we were working. As far as my knowledge as an attorney when I was working for Con Ed in the city, they were, of course, very proud where Con Ed, Consolidated Edison, being named after Edison. Edison developed his DC power plant down, I think, at the Pearl Street plant. And it turned out, Jeff, that because of the line loss, the resistance, the heating up, and the inefficiency of the delivery of the power by direct current, they would have had to have installed, I think, additional generation every couple of miles. Whereas if you look at the AC power coming out of Niagara Falls AC Tesla design, what are we talking? Down to New York, that's got to be, what, 200-300 miles. I mean, you do that on your motorcycle every so often. You'd know how far that is. And it loses, of course, some line loss. And because they also, Jeff, carry three different phases usually, each of these are sinusoidal electromagnetics of currents going plus and minus. There are usually conductors that are separated with each line carrying electricity about 120 degrees out of phase with the next line. They're able to then bundle these lines together to also reduce the overall electromagnetic radiation and the other interaction of the lines' delivery of the AC power. So I don't know if that's responsive, but yeah, I agree. DC power is not the way to go for a long transmission distances.
All right. Thanks for answering that, Brandon, because it was a tangent. Could you talk about how you got involved in working with geothermal energy?
Well, let me at least say that without my family keeping me out in the campground and encouraging my love of nature, I probably wouldn't have taken those great high school earth science and advanced placement physics courses. So with earth science and physics under my belt, I seem to have a natural gift for, and a lot of, I'm going to call it luck. I was very lucky to get into the Colorado School of Mines, that's MINES, and by 1976, I decided I'd switch over to geophysics. At the time, Dr. George V. Keller and others were the chair of geophysics, became my mentor, later on my boss and a friend. He's now deceased, unfortunately. And he was the top, really, in the United States. So they put me out in the field very fast. And the first few summers during my work at the geophysics department of the School of Mines had me working, funny to hear, Jeff, fossil fuel for Peabody Coal, doing a magnetic survey to try to determine the underground fire-destroyed coal clinker, and then instead of drilling many holes. The next summer, I ended up working for Sunoco up in an oil field to try to determine where oil had migrated. And I didn't really like to see, Jeff, what the coal open-pit mines left the earth in a state of ruin or the wasteland of oil fields. So Dr. Keller had by this time started some private companies. One was the Geothermal Research and Development Corporation or company out in Hawaii. I would ultimately be hired by his company, Geothermal Kinetics Exploration Group called Group 7. And because I was sort of like the wunderkind or the golden boy, I always seemed to be lucky enough that even if I didn't know what I was exactly doing, Earth spirits were with me, and I came back with results. So they gave me increasing responsibilities. So in terms of involvement with geothermal, the government, too, at the time, was beginning to decide that in addition to, by this time, maybe 1,500 megawatts or 2,000 megawatts were solely being generated at the geysers plant there north of San Francisco by Union Geothermal, the government started to invest in wet steam or very high-pressure, high-temperature water that if you brought to the surface would flash the steam. And so there was money invested in a lot of different companies, including Geothermal Kinetics, my Group 7 I was crew chief of. And so we were then let loose to all those now, what you say, are 20 or so geothermal electricity generating plants in the western U.S. So we basically did the initial field exploration using geophysics to determine the aerial extent and the quality of the steam or hot water. So that's how I pretty much got involved, and I continue it because I listen to great programs like In Other News and also Europe being producer of Law and Disorder, and I hear in both of those programs the beckoning call of continuing to stimulate alternative renewable or free energy alternatives, and of course the degradation of the environment and the end result of the disorder of the fossil fuel industry's heavy hand.
Thanks for the compliment. I really appreciate that. And there is quite a remarkable WBAI listener community out there. And
only because of the quality of your guests, Jeff. I mean, Dane Wigington, Peter Champeau, Cindy Pagoulis. I forget Constantine's full name.
Dr. Korotkov Constantine.
I've been a regular listener, and I mean, I'm glued to and am so enthused and share it and replay it. And it's really changed me from being the, say, narrow-minded, dismissive, orthodox, educated, and also attitude attorney being through university training here by being then molded, shaped, in these, I will call, postdoc years of listening to your program for about 7 or 8 years, and then going back to listening to Robert Knight or to Dennis Bernstein. My family has been listening for maybe 30 or more years, and because we've been fortunate enough, we've been able to send as supporters in the excess of thousands of dollars because of the value back. It's been a great return on investment. Thank you.
That's really good news, Brandon. I wanted to ask you more about free energy and the path toward that as our private and military infrastructure continue to depend generally on fossil fuel energy. Can you talk about your experiences working as a geophysicist and what you've learned about the accessibility of free energy, renewable, or alternative energy on the planet?
Yeah, you and I have spoken about this, and the last time we chatted, you were kind of narrowing it down to, well, can you talk a little bit more about solar, your knowledge and experience? And, you know, I think this is the thing people really forget. If we look at the use and the derivative alternative renewable and free energies that we can attribute to the sun, let's just go through a quick list. Passive solar heat and light have been used just as in caves, in alcoves, by native peoples walking around for 50,000, 100,000 years. Active solar collectors, the Greeks in India, probably for thousands of years, have been using reflectors and the like. The sun also contributes, like the moon, to gravity and tides and produces ocean currents and the like. The sun evaporates water and produces what's known as the hydrologic cycle, which then can help us run hydroelectric or oceanic currents and plants. The sun differentially heats the surface of the earth, producing then the capacity for atmospheric winds due to temperature and pressure differences to flow. Insulation, of course, does give geothermal energy on the near surface some contribution, but of course it is baking the earth by microwave and other radiations. And of course, when stars like our sun blow up, elements like uranium, thorium, and other nucleides are available for then nuclear. All the elements, hydrogen and carbon, are produced. Hydrogen stars become helium stars as they fuse. Helium stars become carbon-based stars. It's hydrocarbons that produce all of our fossil fuels. And really, when we want to talk about fossil fuels, we're talking about solar energy. And, Jeff, I know I'm bending your ear here, but just two others. Solar energy, too, through photovoltaics, can produce by electrolysis hydrogen. Hydrogen gas can be used in fuel cells. And finally, photosynthesis from the sun in plants can produce biofuels. So if you want to go through the list, seriatim, Jeff, we basically owe everything to Ra, the Egyptian god, and the sun.
Have you noticed there doesn't seem to be any noteworthy efforts in terms of infrastructure to transition out of a fossil fuel-based energy system and into a free energy, renewable energy system? It implies that the banks and oil companies may not be interested in a smooth transition. And if for some reason a new energy system is imposed, it could be a bumpy ride, meaning something like destroying infrastructure as a false flag, for example, to get an insurance payoff, those types of things. Do you think about that aspect of it?
Yeah, Jeff, it's the truth. And you and I are struggling here in this fossil fuel 10,000-year-old or more internal combustion technology where, for instance, the photoelectric effect has been proven since the 1830s. Yeah, it took Einstein and the turn of the century to come forward with the formulations, and it wasn't until Bell Laboratories in the late 1950s, produced the first available, say, photovoltaic electric generating cell. But Jeff, because I've been an attorney and I've worked on a lot of, say, old power plants that were coal or oil or gas fired, I'm really dispirited to have to concede the fact that with big D and big M, the dominant model fossil fuel industry is such a stranglehold and manipulates the market in such a way that, of course, we've seen the result, Jeff. And it's clear that as fossil fuel prices go up, barrel of oil approaches again now $100, what's it, 70 now again, private industry is investing in alternative and renewable energies. And, of course, the current administration is very much, it seems to me, married more so to fossil fuel than to give tax incentives or grants and the like to alternative renewables. In the same way, the market forces dominant model fossil fuel industry like OPEC or domestically, as they drop prices, they were also then able to discourage people from pursuing alternative renewable or free energy choices. And in fact, Jeff, what happened to me was I stayed in college too long, got involved in Group 7 geothermal work, and then the price of oil and even uranium for fissile use in reactors, the prices dropped again. We got through the 79 oil embargoes, some people will recall. So even some of our geothermal ventures became anti-economic because there's a huge upfront cost to have to drill the uncertain results of a geothermal well. So let me just say two other areas. The industry itself, the bankers, investors, are using the dominant model to mess with the market forces in terms of pricing, and can thwart the build-out and market penetration of alternative renewable free energy. But I want to now look at the citizen. The citizen has grandfathered in internal combustion an automobile, a basement furnace, hot water heater, usually a gas burner stove, maybe, say, $50,000, $100,000 investment value. They want to get the full life use of them. And biofuels, hydrogen, are not readily available. And it seems to me that government bureaucracies and also other industry entities want to somehow play out this string, Jeff, and keep us dangling because of grandfathered intransigence. Sometimes it's fear of new, but it's also loss of control. You and I both understand, follow the money. And so some of these industries, like Exxon and others, are starting to go into biofuels. They see the writing on the wall, and they're beginning to transition out of, you know, the standard fossil fuel. So let's blame not only the dominant model industry, somewhat the fear of new of the citizens, and other, you know, dynamics here.
Organizations and the groups, especially in Silicon Valley, that are pretending to come up with new ideas, but they're really trying to control. They're networked with the Central Intelligence Agency and other related groups to collect data and dominate with self-driving cars and the Tesla Auto Works. And that's not going to be the answer. They're going to pretend that they will bring it forth, but there's something wrong in that area as well. And in that context, what are your thoughts on frequent guest Dane Wigington's comments about diminished solar energy uptake caused primarily by deliberate release of jet aerosol particulates?
Well, it's certainly occurring. Seeing is believing. He's out there in California. I'm here on the East Coast. And were it not for Cindy Pergulis' work in Suffolk County, I'm here in Nassau County, the planes would still be with the aerosols spraying horizontal lines up in the atmosphere for me to watch out my east-facing bedroom window, to my distress to see then how the lines turn into the cast of almost like a canopy, blotting out the sun, persisting often for the whole day. So what's happening on the East Coast, where I thought Dane was over on the West or Best Coast, he's definitely seeing the impact. And being, as Dane is, involved in photovoltaics, Jeff, we've got to appreciate that those spraying events, which are now an industry of geoengineering manipulation of incoming sun, clearly happens. But those particulates also fall onto the surface of the photovoltaics as well. Now, Dane, from the last time I heard your two-hour program with him, which was really exceptional, I'm happy you've been able to replay it for listeners who didn't get it during the daytime, he has been reporting as much as 70 or 80% reduction in the efficiency or electricity generated by photovoltaics. And here's the real clincher. You and I also have recently heard that Governor Jerry Brown is talking about creating a new law in California that all new buildings, maybe residential, commercial, industrial, must be self-sustaining with solar energy, which I take to be photovoltaics. And now, isn't it just basically insane if maybe California's geoengineering industries continue to spray aerosols, particulates are falling, blotting out some of the solar light frequency bands that are particularly necessary for a photovoltaic electricity generation, while in the future, Governor Brown is saying, well, let's go in this direction. It looks like, Jeff, again, people are pulling in different directions. Maybe Governor Brown needs to look up into the sky, see what's happening, and like Suffolk County did, I think, maybe produce a state law that bans that sort of aerosol spraying or geoengineering. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, Brandon, unfortunately, they did not ban geoengineering over Suffolk County. That was a proposal to do so back in 2012, but maybe there's a Mandela effect, and it did get banned.
I'm going to be hopeful, because if programs like yours, people continue to be looking up in the sky and not just at their, you know, social media and bumping into cars and being hit, we will think that the young people will finally, the light will go on, and we're going to see a change in them disconnecting from the past going forward.
You were the editorial assistant to the NREL book, Alternative Fuels and the Environment, edited by Francis Sterrett. NREL, N-R-E-L, stands for National Renewable Energy Laboratory book. This was in 1994. Can you tell listeners about that book and the developments since then?
It was a great opportunity. I had started at New York Institute of Technology here. I was able to teach out at Brookhaven National Laboratories. They were, at the time, trying to clean up their problems of radioactive debris. And in the process of working at New York Institute of Technology, I got assigned the work to do alternative renewable energy projects then at the university. It wasn't, unfortunately, Jeff, until 2008, 8 years after I left, that a big grant came from New York State, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they worked on solar energy buildings and the like. But NREL was previously known as the Solar Energy Research Institute. It was on the backside of South Table Mountain in Golden, Colorado, where I lived. And my mentor, George V. Keller, was principally involved in Carter's Solar Energy Institute, which morphed into NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Since then, in 2000 or so, I was teaching online to places like NASA, Long Island Power Authority, Con Ed, online teaching of alternative renewable energies. We did use some of the publications out of NREL and Dr. Sterrett's book, which was based on a symposium held out in Denver back in 1994, became relevant. My work on the book, because of my geothermal activities, had me particularly capable in the first two chapters to critique and help edit and make some changes substantive to the ocean thermal and earth terrestrial geothermal technology chapters. The funny thing is, Jeff, that was then. Let's jump forward to today, because NREL is still existent. It's been a place where a lot of innovative, say, solar photovoltaics, wind turbine improvements, innovations have been helped along. And in fact, my fossil fuel school, Colorado School of Mines, Oxford of Oil, Princeton of Petroleum of the 1950s and 60s, because of Dr. Keller and maybe Brandon and others' work and NREL, have now formed relationships. So now they are more and more involved in new materials, technologies, and using the knowledge of the geophysicists, geotechnicians there to be able to do Tesla-type experimentation into really utilizable industry-level, robust, alternative, renewable, free energy sources. Let me just, in the last paragraph, say what's happening right now out in Hawaii. You know, with the Kilauea eruption, we always looked at geothermal energy. Again, the chapter I critiqued in the book with Dr. Sterrett, the geothermal energy was always looked at as baseload. Baseload is available pretty much 24/7, 365 days. It's got the highest capacity. In other words, it's designed, say, for 100 megawatts, producing at 100 megawatts almost 95% of the time. So its capacity factor and availability factor is like 10, 20, 30% higher than your standard rotating steam turbine or coal-burning, oil-fired steam turbine electric generator sets. So the bottom line is, though, Jeff, Kilauea has now put a sort of hold on the geothermal wells there in Hawaii, and so the reliability is beginning to be put into question. So, Jeff, the one thing I want to bring home to everyone is to begin to think about a mix of photovoltaics, wind, geothermal heat pumps, to actually own a portfolio or a suite of different means in order to generate necessary heat, light, electricity. And just let me give you a last sentence here. Pricing, if you levelize the pricing for Hawaii-generated electricity sources, that means take out the subsidies, wind is about $175 a megawatt hour in Hawaii. Solar is about $150 a megawatt hour. The fossil fuel burning power plants out there, as much as $200 a megawatt hour because of the cost of bringing oil out to Hawaii, and if it's $100 a barrel. Solar, though, when it's running, is only about $50 a megawatt hour. It's basically a quarter of the fossil fuel. It's then much more sustainable, reliable, and yet now we begin to see even it is you know, in question due to the, you know, occasional volcanic eruption.
In April of 1981, the Los Angeles Times picked up an article by the Associated Press titled "Aurora Borealis Lights Up Sky." The unusual southerly display of the Aurora Borealis Sunday night colored skies along the eastern edge of California, causing a flood of calls to police and prompting one fire department to send out firefighters in search of a blaze. At Edwards Air Force Base, where the skies have been carefully watched in expectation of the space shuttle's Tuesday landing, Sergeant Chris Summerell, a weather station operator, said he had seen the glow. And the article continues, Brandon, you actually knew what was going on at that time. Can you tell listeners about what had happened?
Yeah, it was a really remarkable, almost serendipitous event. I do take some credit for being a contributor to it. Essentially, Group 7, I was crew chief of this field geophysics exploration group from Geothermal Kinetics, was sent out to a geothermal prospect, not much surface manifestation, called Agua Caliente, hot water in Spanish, a little bit west of Gila Bend, and it was right up near what's known as Painted Rock Dam along the Gila River. A magma chamber was thought to exist 30 or 40 kilometers into the interior of the Earth. And Dr. Keller and Dr. Kaufman had determined that if you could stimulate the Earth with a huge electromagnetic pulse, which we were doing, you could then produce a sort of secondary current in that conductive magma in the interior of the Earth, and it would produce a secondary field that we could detect with a magnetometer. It sounds very exciting and complex, but simply what we did was we had a megawatt generator fired with diesel fuel. We laid down 9,000 feet of cable. The cable was as thick as your thumb. Two electrode pits with big pieces of sheet iron, and we were driving with a switch box, huge amounts of 500 volts, 2,000 amps of current into the Earth in a square waveform, switching it on and off quickly every, say, 15 seconds. Now, Jeff, that's like the HARP devices almost. It's producing such a huge EMP that not only did we stimulate charges on the surface of the magma chamber below, but a lot of the energy was reflected up into the ionosphere. And Jeff, it just so happened, and here's the serendipitous event, that we were coming off of the sun's own 21st cycle of a solar spot maximum. So a lot of solar energy was still coming into the Earth in 1981. We're now stimulating the ionosphere with this huge amount of electrical power, and ultimately, we turn out to also be working over what Ross Hamilton calls, he's a researcher, author, the Great Western Meridian. It's a ley line that goes basically from southern Arizona through Utah up towards the Yellowstone area. So put those three things together, and so there we are out at night, Jeff, working, and we begin to see what looks like a prairie fire all the way around us. Red glow begins to top off to then being curtains, really like red neon light, brilliant red with striations, aurora borealis in an oval shaped. Now, why would it be in an oval shape? Remember putting the barb magnet with a piece of paper and the iron filings, and then you would be able to get that oval shape? So our 9,000-foot cable with all that electric power going in, contemporaneous with the solar energy maximum from the sun, as well as being in a ley line, seem to have come together to produce an aurora oval. And let me just give you two confirmations. In 2012, I called to the National Optical Observatory at Kitt Peak, and the operator then said to me, Brandon, that was a once-in-a-hundred-year aurora borealis that never occurred down here. So I explained to him how we sort of were contributing to it. The next day I called him back. His boss said, don't talk to Brandon anymore because there's resistance here, Jeff, from NSF and other entities not wanting to get involved to give credence to serendipitous events that we geo wizards are producing. This year, in anticipation of possibly speaking with you on radio, your program and other news, I called the National Radio Astronomy observatory there in Socorro, New Mexico, and they basically were very resistant to allow me into the information. It's now public domain, but I spoke to the principals there, and each time they were deflecting my interest on the 13th of April, 1981. It carries over due to the universal time clock into actually the first few hours of April, I guess that would be 14th, 1981. So if anyone's listening, Jeff, who's an astrophysicist, please go to the public access files. And if you're an astrophysicist, I'm just a mean little geophysicist here, see if you can't find by comparing before and after 24 hours on that time frame, whether or not you also see anomalous, you know, like aurora excitations in the L-band frequency gigahertz range that the radio telescope would have been observing there, because it happened. I mean, Edwards Air Force Base saw it happen, and we were chagrined because we're trying to find the magma chamber in our feet, and all we could do was shut down the very sensitive magnetometer and continue to enjoy and watch the beautiful striational red curtain aurora oval above.
Yeah, quite an event, and they saw it. Northeast of Sacramento and south to Riverside County, east of Los Angeles. At that time, they all reported that strange red glow in the sky.
Tesla was getting that in the Colorado Springs Laboratory here on Long Island, the Wardenclyffe. I mean, clearly, air glow is something that does occur rarely, but, you know, there are things called earthquake lights and corona sometimes when the piezoelectric quartz rocks are being pressed. So, you know, there are natural processes here like huge solar storms and the like that can produce, and you've even seen it here maybe in New York State and the like. Sometimes you get to see the aurora. But when it's as closed as an oval, the aurora oval usually only occurs over the polar regions because it's oval because of the shape of the natural Earth fields at those locations. So here, definitely an anomalous ground event contribute to the huge western, Great Western Meridian ley line, and as well the solar maximum. So, Jeff, I'd like to take some credit. I think we need to acknowledge Tesla as well as being really the brains behind this operation.
Well, Brandon, that area you were delivering that voltage in the ground is near sacred sites, and you've done analysis on sacred sites and war memorials that are often one and the same. Can you talk about that type of research and what is revealed among Native American cultures, their land, treaties, and how the consciousness in the land energy is thought to influence events today?
Wow, that's quite a question. Let me just say that where the aurora oval over southern Arizona was contributed to by my geophysics operations through Group 7. Again, I'm the guy who's the field crew chief. I picked up an interest by working with the likes of Vine Deloria Jr., Ross Hamilton, and others who've written extensively. But to bring this down to ground, while I was at Agua Caliente, I went up to the Painted Rock Dam along the Gila River, and it's called Painted Rock because there are these petroglyphs all over pecked into the rock. So the Native American Indians, who happen to be possibly enjoying the benefit of nightlights occasionally, but not stimulated by modern technology, were in awe of the possible air glow or the balls of light. And these were, even in the oral tradition, being reported in southern Arizona over on the other side of the aurora oval, near what's known as Casa Grande. It's a adobe mound national park place, but it was supposedly an observatory too. The third place where the aurora oval touched was Mount Graham, where the Apache say the Gaan, G-A-A-N, or their Kachinas exist up at the top of the mountain. Now, let's look at these three sites quickly. At Casa Grande, the observatory has been usurped by the Park Service and is protected, but in the local Pima Maricopa Indian tradition, they continue to see balls of light and call them spirits, their gods, their earth spirits, the elementals. And so there's a great reverence for not disturbing the area. If you look at the pottery in the ground, you can see spirals and oval shapes being painted, reflecting what they see in the sky. Over at the Painted Rock petroglyph site, again, we see ovals and spirals and wavy lines. So I think what they are doing is memorializing and recording. The thing that's most disturbing, though, Jeff, is at Mount Graham. And they call it the Pope Scope, a little bit irreverent, but the Vatican, some years ago, when the SDI technology didn't use a mirror and lens that was going to be in a laser space-based platform, they then took some of that and put it into a scope, an optical telescope, to then occupy Mount Graham. And Mount Graham in southern Arizona also had the Aurora Oval observed. I spoke to Dale Miles, who was the San Carlos Apache historian, and he acknowledged it. And then while we're talking, he said, isn't it funny, Brendan, when you're calling, that there's a fire burning up the side of Mount Graham? And right now, Jeff, you got to know that if a optical observatory has, you know, like bare soil and ash flying around, that it becomes less of a good site for observation. And what the Vatican was doing was usurping what was occurring with the night lights, the geophysical air glow, what have you, of the traditional mountain where the gods lodged. And so we really feel, Jeff, that the gods are taking it back, that the fire frustrating, not burning the building down, but producing more dust in the atmosphere. The movement now for the Pima and Maricopa to also try to get back some of the land, to maybe thwart some of the build-out of some of the power plants and the like. So there's a real movement now again, Jeff. I think the pendulum is swinging back.
Can you give listeners some information about related ongoing secret projects that you've known about and may have been involved with?
This is really an interesting area. I'm going to call what is traditionally known by pop culture as UFOs, advanced aerial vehicles. Now, give you a few quick examples. When I was in Golden, Colorado, South Table Mountain had, in 1950, if you look at Passport to Magonia by Vallée, in the back,
Jacques Vallée.
Jacques Vallée has an account in 1950 that advanced aerial vehicle was seen to be landing on South Table Mountain in 1950. Well, it turns out that the founder of geophysics at the School of Mines is Dr. Carl A. Hyland. So let me give you another book, A Need to Know by Timothy Good. On page 117, it says, Dr. Carl A. Hyland, a geophysicist expert in magnetism, was possibly part of what was known then, Jeff, as the secret faculty. Secret faculty was an augment of what is known as Majestic or MJ-12. And the scientist in charge of this branch of the research and development branch was Vannevar Bush. So I do believe that my department geophysics founder, Dr. Carl A. Hyland, because of his magnetics expertise, was possibly dabbling with maglev in the 50s. So even if the UFO by Jacques Vallée, as recorded in his book Passport to Magonia, is specious as so far as being extraterrestrial, I do believe that we were trying to do what's known as reverse engineer what? Well, Jeff, one of the first sites I was sent to was the crash site, the second crash site of the Roswell event over near Socorro, New Mexico, where the very large array, the radio telescope, again, recall earlier we discussed the radio telescope, and basically was a site where a landing occurred. In fact, a crash occurred.
Sorry to interrupt. I've got that in front of me. This is in Passport to Magonia. Policeman Lonnie Zamora observed the landing of a white craft resting on four legs in a depression of 4 kilometers outside Socorro. Near it were standing two figures below average height, dressed in white. Within 30 meters of the object, he saw red insignia on its aluminum-like surface. It rose to 4 meters with a strong roar. It became silent, hovered, and flew away.
Agreed. Yeah, I would have to say that if these craft are not of the Earth, if there are beings coming here in what we will call UFOs, I do believe that they would go to places like Socorro. like the other hot springs areas where there might be magma chambers. And for why? Why would they be drawn there? Well, there is possibly radioactive isotopes available. There would be mercury. Mercury is used possibly in maglev, hydronium. There would be species available during the wintertime, heat drawing people and cultures there. So if you were to be like Star Trek and we need to re-up our dilithium crystals and you're over the Earth looking down, let's go to the hot springs and see some maybe beautiful bathing babes down there, or pick up some interesting species, or get some uranium, mercury. Even gold and silver are known to occur in the Socorro area. And then I'd just like to wrap up to say that Group 7 possibly sent me in a follow-on to what's known as Project Moondust, which I call Moondust Plus, to find the geothermal anomalies, be they thermal springs, magma chambers, sources of mineralization, radioactive elements at these sites that were then, or previously rather, visited by beings, other entities who were going to make beneficial use and maybe harvest the elements and the energies there. So it's an interesting overlay. I'm still working at that.
And you got paid to do this work?
It was just amazing. I'll tell you this, Mr. Jeff Brady. It was the best years of my life. I hang a lot of my current success and my reinventing myself on my field geophysics experiences. Whenever we talk about some of these secret projects, we seem to get a lot of clicks and beeps and disruptions of telephonic communication. So I'm so very pleased that we've been able to maintain during this interview.
I do find that really odd. Not one interruption. Okay, so the South Table Mountain, where you had referenced the landing or the sighting, it's in Passport to
Magonia.
Yeah, Mr. Quintana of Denver saw a silvery ovoid, silvery green ovoid object hovering about 15 meters above a slope and landing slowly in a small ravine. Then it shot upward at a very high speed. Its diameter was about 20 meters, and it had a revolving middle band. A greenish light flashed under it, and the witness felt a rush of air and a pungent smell.
Truly. The funny thing is it's right around the time when Carl, my department chair at the time in the 1950s, Dr. Carl A. Hyland, was probably working as part of the secret faculty to reverse engineer. So let's just suggest the possibility that it was one of our secret projects, maglev or electric gravitic propulsion for doing the sorts of non-combustion levitation devices. So I just happened to be living in the 1970s on the other side of South Table Mountain there in Golden, and NREL, that National Laboratory, happens to be on the other side of South Table Mountain. I do think it's very interesting and thought-provoking to suggest that, again, the U.S. government particularly chooses to put installations, military bases, and the like on these landing sites where the, if not UFOs, other entities have found of interest. And so tell a good story here, Jeff. You tell me. Make the connections. They're beyond my imagination.
Well, Brandon, the connections that could be made from your experiences in working with the School of Mines and then attaining more information about sacred land and subsequent paranormal events, well, on the surface, they have a continuity with how the U.S. government and or military cordon off sensitive areas of geography to build bases or secret installations that usually have private access only. In one capacity, it suggests that mineral-rich areas may have a wider range of interest than human beings. This is consistent with the experiences of past guest Allison Cruz, who captured a lot of unusual advanced aerial vehicle activity around her home in rural Pennsylvania. Allison, through her very thorough independent research, determined the AAV or UFO activity was centered around a vast system of tunnels beneath the hills. Part of that labyrinth is left over from an abandoned mining operation. Well, there's more to cover in terms of your involvement in secret projects, but let's maybe consider getting more into that realm in another show. Dr. Brandon Brigadier, attorney and geophysicist, thanks again for being on In Other News and supporting WBAI.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guest.
Child, baby.